without wider testing, just what the board was created to do. In October, White House officials reportedly disregarded a proposal from testing experts to send rapid tests directly to Americans in anticipation of a COVID-19 spike during the holidays. Press Secretary Jen Psaki also infamously dismissed the idea in a December briefing. Later that month, the Biden administration announced it would send tests directly to Americans. But the tests are arriving just as the Omicron wave is receding, and critics have argued that the effort shortchanges communities of color. David Paltiel, professor of public health at Yale University, said, "I think it's damn well about time. It's never too late, but some of us have been screaming and yelling about the idea for more than 18 months. There was no shortage of money for expanding testing. As part of last year's stimulus package, Congress appropriated nearly $48 billion for testing, contact tracing, and other efforts to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That is in addition to $48 billion set aside for testing in 2020. But just like with the board's activities, details about where exactly the money has gone have been hard to come by." Senators Richard Beer and Roy Blunt sent a letter on January 3rd asking for similar information. After Beer's office shared what it had learned, the Biden administration sent ProPublica a one-page rundown of COVID-19 spending recently. The allocation thus far includes $10 billion for testing in schools, $9 billion for manufacturing testing supplies, nearly $5 billion for testing uninsured individuals, and more than $4 billion for testing and mitigation measures for high-risk populations. Nearly $3.9 billion went toward free community testing at pharmacies and federally qualified health centers, and $2.9 billion went to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for expanding labs and testing capacity. More than $1.9 billion has gone toward COVID-19 testing of unaccompanied minors at the U.S.-Mexico border. Communique.
The 2022 Winter Olympic Games kicked off in Beijing on February 4th, making the Chinese capital the first city in the world to have hosted both the Summer and Winter Olympic Games. Now, China prides itself on being the host nation of the sporting event, and there have been record-breaking numbers of viewers. But if you thought the coverage and the news about the Olympics was just sports, well, you'd be flat-out wrong. Before the games even started, they were already shrouded in controversy and heated political debate, specifically about China being the host nation. Many have maintained that this is strictly a sporting event and politics should stay out of it. Others, namely the United States, insists that China's alleged human rights abuses are simply too grave to ignore. And then there are those who would argue that the U.S. is exaggerating those issues for political gain, and more importantly, accusing China of things that it has done itself. Now that would be quite hypocritical. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. So the Winter Olympics of 2022 kicked off on February 4th in China's capital, Beijing. It goes without saying, the Olympics are one of the most popular sporting events on the planet, and this time is no different because virtually every day you see the games among the top news stories. But not so much because of the sports themselves, but rather because of the politics. I mean, sure, if we're being realistic, sports or sporting competitions are often politicized. That's nothing new. And the Olympic Games are certainly no exception, but we cannot deny that this time it's highly antagonistic. And it's important to examine what certain countries are accusing China of, and what their political agenda is. Undoubtedly, this is a very significant moment for China. Its capital, Beijing, is now the world's first dual Olympic city, meaning it has hosted both the Summer and Winter Olympics. And naturally, China views that as a very special thing. It's a very prestigious status for China. Now, of course, the West doesn't see it that way. The West is outraged. Western countries have been attacking China and its Beijing Olympics since before they even started. Already several months prior, the United States just came out and announced that it would be boycotting the Beijing Olympics. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki confirmed the boycott on December 6, 2021.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses.
And of course, whenever the U.S. says, jump, its minions ask, how high? After the White House announced its boycott of the Beijing Olympics, the United Kingdom did the same.
As I've said before, we do not support sporting boycotts, but there are no plans for ministers, or certainly no plans for ministers to attend the Winter Olympics.
So did Canada.
We are extremely concerned by the repeated human rights violations by the Chinese government. That is why we are announcing today that we will not be sending any diplomatic representation to the Beijing Olympic or Paralympic Games this winter.
And so did Australia.
The Australian government will not be sending any official representatives to the forthcoming Winter Games.
So why is the United States, why are the U.S. and its allies boycotting the Beijing Winter Olympics? Well, the official narrative is that they're protesting China's human rights abuses. They claim that China is committing gross human rights violations in Tibet, Hong Kong, and cracking down on Muslims, specifically Uyghurs and other Muslim groups in the Xinjiang province. During the opening ceremony at the so-called Bird's Nest National Stadium, the final Olympic torchbearer was Zhao Jiawen, who is a Uyghur Muslim. Essentially, what China was doing is saying, look, we don't have a problem with Uyghurs or Muslims. We have a problem with separatism. We don't discriminate, so here's a Uyghur athlete, a Uyghur Olympian, opening up the Winter Games. Now, the Western media, of course, were not impressed and didn't waste the opportunity to attack China, claiming that China was using this Uyghur athlete as a token and that the entire thing was done cynically. Danny Haifong joins me now. He's an author, political commentator, and contributing editor at Black Agenda Report. Danny is also the co-host of the YouTube show The Left Lens and co-editor of Friends of Socialist China, a platform that promotes understanding of Chinese socialism. Danny, thanks so much for taking the time. It's really great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's always good to be with you.
Likewise, brother. You know, I wanted to start out with the Beijing Winter Olympics that have just kicked off. In the news, we don't hear so much about the sports. We hear more about the games being boycotted by the United States, the United Kingdom, and co. I've heard people in the United States refer to them as the genocide games. Can I just get your thoughts in general on this whole debacle?
Well, I watched the opening ceremony February 4th. I was up early. I was watching it through NBC News streaming service, and it was just absolutely deplorable. I mean, the level of propaganda that China has been targeted with by the corporate media is astounding, and this has been going on for years, but the corporate media, the military-industrial complex, and these humanitarian interventionists in both camps as well as the political establishment have all coalesced around this human rights narrative to attempt to delegitimize China in this momentous occasion. I mean, it's historic that China is the first dual Olympics country. Beijing is the first dual Olympic city. Many of the facilities are being reused from the 2008 Summer Olympics. It's 100% green powered. And the COVID-19 success that China has had in containing the virus is being implemented to protect both athletes, all the participants, all of the workers, as well as the Chinese people, because this is a huge international event. And when you have a highly contagious pandemic still spreading, China has taken it very seriously. And that has become also the target of attack by the media, by the establishment. And so really, it's a full frontal assault.
Why all this propaganda? What are they trying to accomplish here? Because there is a lot of prestige associated with, as you said, being the first country to host, you know, both Olympics, the first city. So, I mean, what is the root of all this? Why all this propaganda? Why all the vitriol?
Well, I think first and foremost, the vitriol towards China is about the U.S.'s overall geopolitical strategy in the West. The junior partners that the United States has curried favor with because of very similar common interests, imperialism, capitalism, exploitation. This is where the West and the United States, Israel, and all of the allies that the U.S. has been able to obtain, that's where they all can agree upon. And oftentimes, it's not an equal relationship either. It's the U.S. attempting to bully them into really towing the line on the agenda, and the U.S. claims and desires to be a permanent hegemon, a permanent imperial power that has no rival. And so at the most basic level, the United States views China as a legitimate rival, but it's not enough to look at it in that lens, because that can lead to this false equivalency that unfortunately some of our friends on the left make, which is that China is just some equal imperialist power, that actually it's going far beyond what the United States can do. There's a lot of this misinformation that goes around. And so it's important to understand that the United States, if China was indeed an imperialist power, a colonial power, it wouldn't really have a problem with that. It would actually probably be seeking much closer relations in China than it ever even had during the normalization period and during the so-called entrance into the World Trade Organization. Not even that is enough to prove that China and the U.S. were some kind of similar entities. How the United States deals with its so-called allies is through organizing them and enforcing a common agenda that China has never really been a part of, because China is led by a communist party. China has 1.4 billion non-white people. It is a country that proudly espouses socialism, and it is one that really employs a different model of international relations, one that is respective of international law. I mean, that's really at the basic level how China behaves around the world. But then you add in the fact that China's economic model is not just a rival and not just set to surpass the United States in size, but it also is setting a different kind of agenda.
Now, China opened up the Olympic Games with a Uyghur athlete, and that was met with criticism. Do you believe that that was a cynical gesture by China or a genuine gesture? And you know, what if the Olympics had not been opened up by a Uyghur athlete? They would probably still complain about that anyway, right?
It was a really beautiful display that China presented in the opening ceremony as well, was the passing of the national flag among representatives of the 56 ethnic groups. And they were passing the flag, and then it was taken by representatives of the national military. And, you know, there was that. I mean, that was a scene. Like, that was incredible. And it's in response to this. I mean, we can't deny that it's a total response to the fact that the United States and the West have propagandized around this issue for years now, first with concentration camps, then with genocide. And there's no escaping it. So, of course, I think China is totally correct in responding, especially responding in this kind of way, a very professional manner, one that definitely sends a message to Western audiences that China does not adhere to that narrative. China does not believe in that narrative, and that the Chinese people don't believe in that narrative, because the cheers were very loud during that part of the ceremony. And so it's just important to understand that that Uyghur genocide narrative was always dubious. I mean, we can go over the sources probably for hours and hours, from Adrian Zenz, Victims of Communism Foundation, all the way to the Atlantic Council, and all of the institutions and proxies for these institutions that have been rolled out, Radio Free Asia, Conduit of the CIA, I mean, on and on and on. These institutions have repeated this lie over and over and over again, and just basic data it disproves it. And so it's really an agenda. It's about targeting Xinjiang. It's about splitting China apart. It's a losing mission, and it's already lost, because China is more united than ever. And a lot of it is because of this propaganda war, because ordinary Uyghurs, ordinary anyone in China doesn't want the country to be split apart. It doesn't want separatism to be fueled. It doesn't want economic livelihoods to be threatened. So the more that China is attacked by the U.S., the more unified the country becomes. And that's just one of the, I guess, benefits of this, silver linings, I guess, of the U.S.'s failed strategy.
You wrote about Eileen Gu. She's a world. You wrote about Eileen Gu. She's a world class athlete, half American, half Chinese. And she announced in 2019 that she will be representing China in 2022. And you wrote in your article that, quote, Gu has been labeled an ungrateful traitor to the United States for supposedly spurning the opportunities offered to her in the land of the free. I mean, the responses on Fox, where they were saying that she's switched sides and she's turned her back on the United States, you know, the country that raised her and provided her with training and facilities that only the U.S. has. I mean, what does that even mean? Like, other countries don't have anyone who can ski? What do you think of all this?
Essentially, it is a byproduct of a long history of racism toward Chinese, but just in general, right? This racism, this imperialism that the United States has developed over the course of its development is par for the course in reproducing the exploitation that is inherent to the U.S. way of life. And so those who cross the boundaries of what I call political whiteness, which is a tool of imperialism, this idea that you will have solidarity with the so-called enemy other, the country that has been targeted for elimination, destruction, regime change, whatever, that this is akin to renouncing your citizenship. That's what Tucker Carlson called it, and that's what many people are saying, when in fact, Eileen Gu, if you just listen to her words, it's pretty clear. Listen to her words and understand who she is. It's pretty clear that her relationship to China is very deep. It's not that she is doing this for political reasons. She's doing this because, one, she's a citizen of China. Two, her mother is very deeply involved in China's economy. She goes to China nearly every summer before the pandemic. And she has many Chinese sponsors. She's well known in China. And she's making it very clear the more and more pressers she does, because the question is asked over and over again, why'd you do this? Why'd you choose that? What do you think of what people are saying? She was very clear recently, after she won her first gold medal, that she's receiving love. And I don't think people understand that there's a good reason why she chose China over the United States. And I think we're seeing that play out. She is Chinese and she loves China. She loves the Chinese people and she has affinity towards them. They have affinity towards her. She broke the internet after she won the gold medal in China. Weibo shut down because of how many people were sharing and celebrating her victory. And so that's the kind of love she receives. You follow her Instagram, you see every post she's, you know, being mobbed by people, and she's sharing all of the heartfelt messages she's getting from people. And the United States is trying to politicize that, because they see it as a smack in the face. The ruling class sees it as a smack in the face. And a lot of people who have digested this anti-China racism and resentment, they see it as a slap in the face. They see it as an attack on the U.S. itself, on American exceptionalism itself.
it's frankly quite incredible. You know, I know Fox News likes to paint itself as sort of anti-war, but it's really just fueling, you know, this resentment, which, I mean, what good does that do anyone? I think it's very embarrassing, as you just put it. It's really, you know, really telling on yourself by doing that. But I mean, what is this kind of reaction to Eileen Gu tell you about this anti-Chinese racism? Because, you know, this whole hashtag that we saw, like, stop hate against Chinese, but yet there's always antagonism towards China. Like, that doesn't stop, you know? And we've also heard these other myths that, oh, careful going to the Olympics because the Chinese are spying on the athletes, like, you know, as if the NSA hasn't been bugging everyone's phone on the planet. And then, of course, you know, they were also saying how Peng Shui, this tennis player, had gone missing. Can you clue us in on all of this?
Well, it's more propaganda, and there's just been an onslaught, right? I mean, Peng Shui, she was unfortunately exploited by the media, the Western media, for a post that she made about a former Chinese official, former vice premier, Jiang Guoli, who supposedly was accused of sexual assault, but really it sounded like a complex situation, and certainly there may be things to investigate there. But the problem with it was that it was mistranslated, it was taken into account, and then there was a rumor that she was missing altogether, and that China had somehow detained her or disappeared her. And all of that wasn't true, right? Within a day of that accusation, photos of her on WeChat, video of her at a Beijing, you know, teenage skating competition, like they started to emerge. And the agenda is pretty clear here. And she came, and she's come up in the Olympics as well, right? Eileen Gu was asked a question about Peng Shui, and Eileen Gu was like, "I'm happy that she's here and that she's safe," and that's all she said, because she didn't want to get into the politics of it, because there's a lot of politics in this. The United States, if you just look at the corporate media coverage, it's not just Peng Shui, it's everything.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I think it's obvious to anyone who's paying attention that every single accusation made by the United States, every charge leveled against China, is hypocrisy of the highest order. You want to talk about genocide against Muslims? Sure, let's talk about genocide against Muslims. Who bombed Afghanistan? Who bombed Iraq? Who bombed Syria? Who bombed Libya? Who bombed Yemen? Who bombed Somalia? Who bombed Pakistan? Who attacked Iran? The United States literally destroys half the Middle East, half West Asia, and then they have the nerve to talk about Muslims? You have the nerve to pretend you care about Muslims? I mean, this is an insult. You know, let's talk about locking up Muslims in camps. The United States has a torture camp, Guantanamo Bay, that is reserved solely for Muslim men that have been kidnapped around the world, rendered, and kept there for years and years and years without charge, without trial. A few months ago on this program, I spoke to Mansour al-Daifi, who was kept in Guantanamo Bay for 14 years, no charge, no trial. Here, listen to what he has to say about how much respect the Americans have for Muslims.
They used to take the Holy Quran, put it on their feet, pee on it, throw what? It on the ground. Yeah, the interrogators, yes. Stopping us from praying, mocking us. I remember when I used to pray, they would throw us the Israeli flag or the American flag. Sometime there was, like, we call it the satanic room, where they have a room, and dark room, where they put candles, and the floor is like satanic stars and signs.
What?
It is crazy. I told you, Guantanamo was an experimenting lab.
Okay, so what does all of this mean? Does this mean that China is perfect and everything it does is perfect? Absolutely not. No country is perfect. But this is some staggering, blistering hypocrisy. And then, of course, some people will say, well, you know, two things can be bad at once. Yeah, sure, the problem is the media that are constantly attacking China and calling China out never call out the United States. And more importantly, the crimes perpetuated by the United States are systemic and on an unimaginable global scale. The United States doesn't just attack Muslims at home in the U.S. It literally goes around the globe invading Muslim countries and slaughtering Muslims in the street, in the market, in their bedrooms. It's not even comparable. And you know, you hear a lot nowadays about China's human rights record in the media. Well, let me jog your memory. You see, it's not that long ago that the U.S. enjoyed a somewhat good relationship with China. Hillary Clinton, who was then the Secretary of State, actually went to China in 2008. And she was singing a very different tune compared to what you hear now.
Driving on the Third Ring Road in Beijing, I felt like I was watching a movie in fast forward. From a few high-rise buildings on my last trip to a gleaming Olympic complex and corporate skyscrapers today. We welcome China's role in promoting peace and stability in the Asian Pacific. Over the past 30 years, the United States has helped to foster security in the region, and that has been a critical factor in China's growth and an important strategic interest of our own.
I didn't hear Hillary Clinton complaining about Tibet. After all, Tibet is not an issue that just started yesterday or with the Beijing Olympics. So how come no one was mentioning it back then? I guess those human rights issues weren't so important back then, were they? And there was nothing about Uyghurs. There was nothing about Hong Kong. How weird. You see, the problem is that most people, especially Westerners, don't understand the geopolitical games being played by their governments. Let me spell this out as simply as I can. The West does not care about Muslims. The West does not care about Uyghurs. The West does not care about Kurds. Uncle Sam doesn't care about anyone. As soon as the United States is done using someone for political gain, they drop them like a hot potato. So now you see, all of these claims that the US and its allies level against China are not only dubious, but extremely hypocritical. And this bitterness, this jealousy that's expressed in the form of Olympics coverage, it's all part of America's new Cold War on China. The US is crumbling from within while China succeeds. And that breeds jealousy, hatred, and war because the US feels threatened by an alternative model. You see, when China was playing ball and not so much of a rising power, that was fine. But now that China is a real contender and set to overtake the United States to become the world's largest economy, now it's a different story. The United States does not like competition. It does not like that China's system makes its system look obsolete. And it doesn't want the world shifting from US hegemony to a multipolar system. The United States is crumbling, literally. The infrastructure is falling apart. There's a homelessness crisis, wealth inequality, racial inequality. And meanwhile, China is busy linking up its country with high-speed rail and lifting millions of people out of poverty. And the world sees this and knows. And that's precisely why over 120 countries have signed up to join China's Belt and Road Initiative, because they know that is where the future lies. It doesn't lie in some archaic, capitalist, greedy imperialist system that spawns nothing but conflict and destruction. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Sources in the Pentagon have told Reuters that the Biden administration is poised to propose a budget for national defense that could top $800 billion for fiscal year 2023, an enormous sum that far exceeds the levels reached at the peaks of the Korean and Vietnam Wars or during the Reagan buildup of the 1980s. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by William Harting, journalist. This article is published under the heading Massive Folly. Biden's 2023 defense budget could top $800 billion. Here's more on the story. Sources in the Pentagon have told Reuters that the Biden administration is poised to propose a budget for national defense that could top $800 billion for fiscal year 2023, an enormous sum that far exceeds the levels reached at the peaks of the Korean and Vietnam Wars or during the Reagan buildup of the 1980s. It is also more than three times what China spends on its military and 10 times what Russia spends. The figure apparently includes items beyond the Pentagon budget proper, such as spending on nuclear weapons at the Department of Energy, along with billions in defense-related spending at other government agencies. The administration's proposal is misguided and counterproductive, but not unexpected. A Pentagon review of the U.S. Global Force posture released late last year was a status quo document that failed to call for significant reductions in the U.S. military deployment in the West Asia region, even as it signaled an intention to bulk up the U.S. presence in East Asia. And as Queen's Institute distinguished non-resident fellow Joseph Cronison has noted, the Biden administration's forthcoming nuclear posture review is likely to leave the Pentagon's 30-year plan to build a new generation of nuclear-armed bombers, submarines, and land-based missiles largely intact at a cost of up to $2 trillion. Military hawks are already circling, suggesting that the Biden proposal will not be sufficient to keep up with inflation, to the detriment of military readiness. These cries for more ignore the fact that there is ample room to scale back from current levels, given better budget discipline at the Pentagon and, most importantly, a new, more realistic strategy that doesn't cast the United States in the role of global policeman. On the question of spending discipline, the Pentagon is the only major federal agency never to pass an audit. It can tell taxpayers exactly where its money is going, nor does it have an accurate inventory of equipment and spare parts, leading to systematic duplication and waste. The department routinely overpays for basic items like spare parts. In one case involving the notorious supplier TransDigm, there was an astonishing markup of 3,800% on a single part and overcharges on a sampling of components totaling $20.8 million. This is a small change by Pentagon standards, but multiplied by thousands of suppliers, it no doubt adds up to billions in overcharges. On a larger scale, the Pentagon too often buys weapons that are overpriced, dysfunctional, or unnecessary. A case in point is the F-35 combat aircraft, the most expensive single weapons program ever undertaken by the Pentagon. It is being rushed into service before testing has been completed, resulting in costly retrofits for design flaws that are still being detected. It has over 800 unresolved defects, is extremely difficult to maintain, and costs $38,000 per hour to operate. These and other serious problems led House Armed Services Committee Chair Adam Smith to remark that he was tired of pouring money down the F-35 rat hole. Add to the F-35 systems like $13 billion aircraft carriers that have trouble launching and landing aircraft and vessels like the littoral combat ship that can't operate in high-intensity combat environments, and it is clear that there is ample room to cut procurement of big-ticket items without undermining the security. The biggest area of savings in Pentagon spending would flow from the development of a new strategy that puts diplomacy first, ends the forever wars, reduces the nuclear arsenal while maintaining deterrence, and takes a more realistic view of the security risks posed by countries that the Pentagon claims as pacing threat guiding its spending plans. This approach would free up funds to address the most urgent threats to security, from pandemics to climate change to economic inequality. With democracy in balance, it's time to focus on building a strength and resilience at home rather than preparing for misguided military adventures abroad. Maintaining over 750 military bases, hundreds of thousands of troops overseas, counter-terror operations in at least 85 nations, and allocating more than $800 billion for the military will only weaken America while distracting attention and siphoning off resources needed to deal with the non-military challenges that pose the greatest threats to human lives and livelihoods.
Welcome back to Aperture. We follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rootlands that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country. And their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years, Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word Zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word Zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower Saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a school teacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people too hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain, but there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems, but Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Well, perhaps next time you'll enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiyar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.